Welcome to Process This, a podcast for the sterile processing community. The Healthcare Sterile Processing Association, HSPA, invites you to log on, listen, and learn twice a month. Now it's time to process this with your host, clinical educator, John Wood.
Welcome to the Process This podcast. This is episode 105. Today we are talking with Ann Hewitt and Bob Stroud from Senron, and we're talking about drying of medical devices and instrumentation. They have some great information to share with us, so let's not waste any time and let's get the show started. Ann and Bob, thank you for joining me on the podcast today.
Thank you for having us. This is my second time, and I'm very pleased and honored to be invited back.
And John, thank you for coordinating this. We really greatly appreciate it. And thank you to all those who are listening in sterile processing departments throughout the U.S. We appreciate everything you do every day.
So again, today we're talking about drying of surgical instruments and medical equipment. So why is it important to dry instrumentation and medical devices prior to further processing?
From a clinical perspective, or also say from an infection prevention perspective, it's vitally important. Everybody knows that residual organic matter or soil can act like a barrier between the surface of the device and the sterilant. That's kind of common knowledge, I think. The same is true for even a drop of moisture. So if there is moisture on a device, the sterilant cannot penetrate through it. And that's true even if it's steam at high pressure. Additionally, if you didn't care about infection prevention potential, you probably care a little bit about guidelines. Both AMI ST79 and AORN recommend that all devices must be thoroughly dried prior to sterilization. So that's why it's important.
So most sterile processing professionals understand that drying is important for that low temperature sterilization. And mainly it's because most of the time the sterilizer will abort the cycle if moisture is detected. Now, does this mean that drying is more important for low temperature sterilization than for your standard steam sterilization processes?
Well, John, what that means to me is that the sterile processing professionals are very aware of the implications of failure to dry with low temperature sterilization than they are with steam sterilization. Low temperature sterilizers truly recognize moisture as an impediment to proper sterilization and cycle completion. So the cycle will abort, preventing the accidental delivery of non-sterile product to the OR. However, those canceled low-temperature cycles do come with a high cost, and that high cost includes both time and materials. So the sterilant would need to be replaced, the wraps would need to be replaced, the chemical indicators would need to be replaced. So that additional labor increases the cost of the load that was canceled and the time it takes to actually finally complete the load, leading to some frustration with among staff.
That's an understatement.
Steam sterilizers, with their dry saturated steam under pressure, do not have the ability to detect that moisture in the load, and so there is no cancellation. Now, does that mean that you don't need to dry items before steam sterilization? Absolutely not. In fact, I might argue that it's even more important to dry items before they go into steam sterilizers because the sterilizer is not going to tell you that there's a moisture problem. Your first inkling might be a complaint about moisture from the OR, such as a wet pack. Alternatively, it might be that there was an SSI that could be tracked back to that load. So, loading dry devices and instruments helps to ensure dry devices and instruments are available at the end of the cycle. In addition, moisture in a steam sterilized device has the strong potential to decrease the temperature of the steam to one too low to sterilize successfully. Additionally, anything that is on the surface of a device, as Anne previously mentioned, including a water droplet, acts like a barrier between the sterilant and the surface. So again, I'd say it's absolutely important to dry devices going into steam as well as those going into low temperature, but because the low temperature cycle won't let you fantasize that your devices are sterile, you know they are if the cycle didn't abort and the parameters are met. Your steam sterilizer allows you to maintain a fantasy that could result in a patient injury.
So when I first started using endoscopes as a scrub tech, the scopes were housed in a cabinet. And honestly, I don't think there was anything special about the cabinet except we designated it as the cabinet for endoscopes. Now, can you talk about how we have progressed over the years to the drying cabinets we have today?
John, I'm chuckling a little bit at your question because it tells me that you started working with endoscopes after the industry realized, that hanging the flexible scope just on a peg on the wall was not the optimal way to do things. So the cabinets that you're referencing were definitely an improvement over the peg on the wall. Mm-hmm. They were principally designed with the idea of protecting those delicate, super expensive flexible scopes from damage. With the added implied benefit of assuming that drying would occur because the scopes were hung vertically. In other words, gravity would help them. And the commonly used term, quote, hang to dry, unquote, is related to those early days. A lot of research has been conducted on drying of flexible endoscopes in the last 10 years. Well, actually, I'd say it began nearly 20 years ago when Dr. Larry Muscarella published a report, I think it was in 2006, that detailed that failure to dry these scopes was associated with increases in disease transmission. We never thought that before. In the 1990s, it's hang it and let it drip dry.
Yeah.
By 2013 and 2014, other savvy researchers, Julia Kovaleva and Corey Ofsted, come to mind, they're kind of top of mind for me. They were investigating the relationship between drying and preventing the growth of bacterial biofilms inside scope channels. Research began to recognize and acknowledge that surface tension inside flexible scopes was too high to allow water droplets to drain out. So that would prevent evaporative drying, and it was creating the perfect warm, dark, moist environment for bacteria. They love that kind of environment. Mm-hmm. By the late 20-teens, I would say, there was sufficient research on drying problems in flexible scopes to drive changes in the AMI ST91 standards. So the AMI ST91 2021 standards for reprocessing flexible endoscopes added a big section prescribing a new standard for drying flexible scopes and expanded the definition of high-risk scopes. It used to be just duodenoscopes, but now it includes cystoscopes, bronchoscopes, ureteroscopes, and hysteroscopes because the research shows that they are very high risk. So if it's a flexible scope, it needs to be completely dry after it's been processed and before it goes into storage. Or if it's a scope that's going to be sterilized, which often happens with those high-risk scopes, it needs to be dry before sterilization so that, just like we were talking about a couple minutes ago, there's no residual moisture to prevent successful sterilization.
But what are other risks associated with endoscopes that are not dry?
You kind of implied this in your previous question. If we're talking about flexible GI endoscopes, they're huge, long, they're very complex, they're hard to clean, and they're challenging to dry. So the biggest risk is that an incompletely cleaned scope will be put into storage. Just because they're not designed to be cleaned, they're designed to be diagnostic and therapeutic inside the GI tract. The scope will be warm when it comes out of an AER, and the combination of warmth, darkness, organic matter, and moisture is the perfect recipe for the residual bacteria to grow out. Probably most of our listeners know that bacteria will replicate geometrically, meaning 2 become 4, 4 become 8, and so on. Eventually, 2 can become hundreds of thousands or even millions, which could be ejected into the next patient when a snare or a biopsy forceps will knock it off the internal wall of the scope. Furthermore, any remaining moisture will always provide the ideal environment for the formation of biofilm. And biofilm is practically impossible to see, and it's really difficult to remove. The risk is different for rigid endoscopes, including those for robotic surgeries. With these scopes, they're all being sterilized, or I should say they're all being put into a sterilization process. Then it's the risk of failure to achieve sterilization. I can't repeat frequently enough that drying surgical devices before sterilization is a critical step, including when they're going to be steam sterilized. I often hear from people, I don't need to dry it because it's going into steam. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you've heard that as well. The failure to dry a device completely means that there will be a moisture barrier between the device surface and the sterilant. The risk of using a non-sterile device is pretty difficult to quantify because obviously it depends on a variety of factors like how much moisture was there or the quality of the rinse water in the washer disinfector or how thoroughly the device was cleaned. But if I'm the surgical patient, even if it's a low risk, I am expecting zero exposure to a non-sterile device. I expect that the sterile processing staff know they are supposed to dry the device before sterilization. Those are the risks from my perspective.
So there are several options for drying endoscopes. Can you talk about manual versus automated drying? And in your opinion, is there one method preferred over another?
I'm going to give a short answer, but Bob, I'd love for you to expand on that. My answer would apply both to endoscopes and any other kind of medical device, with one exception that's related to processing flexible scopes in an automated endoscope reprocessor, or commonly called an AER. Many AERs include an alcohol flush and an air purge at the end of a cycle. And I used to think this, and many endoscopy departments currently think this, that this process is sufficient to render the scope dry if it also gets a little hang time. Remember when I said hang to dry earlier? Mm-hmm. Corey Ofsted and her colleagues have recently finished a study that's going to be published in AJIC, in the American Journal of Infection Control, that demonstrates the automated flush and air purge fail to remove water droplets in 100% of the GI scopes that were evaluated, even when the air purge was increased from the normal 3 minutes to add another 10 minutes. So it was a total of 13 minutes. There was still water droplets in 100% of those scopes. I was stunned by that.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah.
That really is incredible when you think about that. And to further that, the manual options that we see in practice include air drying, as in just letting items hang or lie flat in the hopes that ambient air will support evaporation and gravity will facilitate moisture. I don't know about you, but hope necessarily isn't a plan.
Yeah.
Also, hand drying external surfaces and blowing out internal surfaces with compressed air using a handheld air pistol. You know, if you've ever been into SPD or GI and you hear that whoosh, whoosh, whoosh noise in an SPD, well, you know what I'm talking about, right? Yeah. So those air pistols, and they're blowing compressed air on or inside devices. You know, one of the challenges they really need to think about when doing that to make sure that the pressure coming out of that air pistol is being regulated so they're not adding direct air into a lumen that may potentially damage that lumen. So you'd always check with the manufacturer's IFU of that device in terms of what is the pressure specifications noted for that in terms of using those type of air pistols. You know, in addition, my experience with manual versus automated is the same, whether we're talking about washing dishes, washing clothes, using a high-level disinfectant in an AER instead of a basin, or drying medical devices. anything that is automated is going to provide more predictable, consistent results than you'll get with a manual process. The conclusion, as Anne mentioned about the Ofsted study, is that at least 10 minutes of forced air drying is absolutely necessary to dry flexible scope channels completely. And in the SPD, the impact of drying of flexible scopes is really for those high-risk scopes used for cystoscopy, bronchoscopy, ureteroscopes, and hysteroscopes. The recommended processing for these scopes, as we know, is sterilization rather than HLD. So going back to our earlier conversation about moisture impeding the contact of sterilant with a surface, having a dry scope going into a sterilizer, as we mentioned, low temperature, steam, etc., is the only way we can really guarantee that you'll have a sterile scope coming out of the sterilizer. And furthermore, the automated drying that you see in SPD will come in drying cabinets designed for surgical devices. Devices typically processed include trays, containers, cameras, light cords, rigid endoscopes, robotic arms, and just about anything else that you can think of, especially those devices that are being hand washed. Even respiratory devices that they may be processing from respiratory or sleep, those are also candidates that can go into drying cabinets in SPD. So there are a number of manufacturers that have cabinets that will blow the HEPA-filtered warm air from either the top or the bottom of the cabinet. So let's think about that. If the air is coming from the top or the bottom of the cabinet, and the drying cabinets located in sterile processing have shelving in between that airflow, so the air is flowing and containers and trays are being placed on those shelves, what's happening to that air? It's being obstructed and restricted to going into the other direction. So if it's starting at the bottom, the shelves at the top aren't going to get the airflow or the temperature consistency. If it's starting at the top, the ones at the bottom are not getting the airflow or the temperature consistency. So these cabinets generally take a long time to dry devices because there is that inconsistent airflow and temperature in the cabinet, causing cold spots, and shelves full of containers or large devices will impede the airflow so that evaporation doesn't occur evenly throughout the cabinet. And I can confirm that a lot of SPDs think of their drying cabinet basically as a warm storage cabinet because it doesn't really help them manage workflow predictably the way their automated washer or sterilizers do. So they consider their drying cabinet simply a place to put things until they're dry, but there's no predictability of when that's going to be. So it really doesn't improve their workflow. The ideal cabinet really would have the ability to achieve and maintain consistent temperatures and even airflow, regardless of where you put position the devices on a shelf, whether it's at the top, the middle, or the bottom. And assuring consistent temperatures and robust airflow is a combination of the output of the proper size blower motor and heating element. Those two things work together in a drying cabinet. The size of the blower motor and the heating element really providing that warm cabinet environment that has really robust airflow. It could create and sustain that very warm air that will dry items quickly. Wouldn't be specialized. It would have the ability to process everything from containers or trays to tubing, from respiratory to cameras and light cords to robotic arms. And again, providing that predictability and thorough drying. That's what you really are looking for with those cabinets. So, kind of back to your original question about manual versus automated. I think it's true that anytime you can't automate or make something consistently faster and more predictable, the better off the SPD staff are going to be, so that they're just not relying on hope as a plan.
I totally agree.
Hey, let's pause our conversation for just a second. Are you looking to get a CE for this episode? Well, you are in the right place to receive the CE for this episode. Simply click on the link in the episode notes or log on to the MyHSPA website and make sure you use the code HEPA filtered air. Again, the code for this episode is HEPA filtered air. Now, back to our conversation.
In AMI ST91, the flexible semi-rigid endoscope processing standard, it mentions two types of the storage cabinets, the drying cabinets and conventional cabinets. Can you explain the differences between these two cabinets? Are drying cabinets also storage cabinets?
That's a great question. It was a new definition that was included in that. I sat on that committee, and I believe that those definitions are good ones. What we all intended for it to mean was that conventional cabinets for flexible scopes, and this is all related to, as you said, the flexible and semi-rigid endoscopes, conventional cabinets refers to storing them in a chamber that does not have active airflow. And a drying cabinet would be designed to flow filtered air into and across all the surfaces, including internal channels. So some cabinets use instrument air instead of HEPA filtration. Both would be forms of filtering. Instrument air is actually designed for medical devices and it's devoid of moisture. Using it could help accelerate drying time within a drying cabinet. Conventional cabinets are designed to protect the scopes, but they don't have the capacity to facilitate drying. Although honestly, many manufacturers would like us to believe that vertical hanging will lead to dry channels, as we've already talked about. The research suggests this is just a pipe dream. It's not happening.
Drying cabinets can be used for more than just drying endoscopes. What other devices do you regularly see drying cabinets used for?
So drying cabinets, John, those systems can process pretty much anything really that's going to be used in the OR. And again, always check with your device manufacturer relative to instructions for use. But we see a lot of robotic arms hung in drying cabinets, endoscopes, a lot of the containers and trays that will contain light cords and cameras and batteries, etc. We'll see those placed in drying cabinets. We also see, for those facilities that are reprocessing, reusable plastic devices, such from respiratory or sleep labs, such as CPAP masks, tubing, valves, etc. See a lot of those as well in those types of drying cabinets. But again, we always want to make sure that to make sure you check with your device manufacturer's IFU to drying those devices.
So what does the preventative maintenance on a dryer look like, and how important is it to keep up with that maintenance?
You know, I'm a big believer in understanding and using those two terms, preventive maintenance. Preventive is the key, right? So while the benefits of using a drying cabinet are truly significant, the preventive maintenance requirements are pretty simple. Again, check with the manufacturer of the drying cabinet, IFU, regarding the preventive maintenance and regular maintenance required or for those cabinets. Regular ongoing maintenance will include cleaning surfaces of the cabinet, including shelves, doors, controls, etc. It will also include replacing filters. And again, make sure you check with that manufacturer's recommendations of frequency of changing the filters. The filters that I'm speaking about that typically we see end users in SBD replace are designed to maintain the integrity of the electronics and other key components. So when the air is coming into the cabinet, those filters are really help design those critical key components within that cabinet so that the air is filtered before it goes over and past those key components. Also, replacing the cabinet's HEPA filter is critical. So the HEPA filter is responsible for the clean air circulating within the drying cabinet. Again, check with the manufacturer to determine when to replace the HEPA filter. Typically, HEPA filters are going to be replaced on an annual basis, and make sure that you're on a schedule of when to replace that filter so that critical component can keep on and maintain the clean air within your cabinet during cycle use. Now, I've seen a lot of cabinets, believe me. All the hospitals that I've visited, and I've seen some of them on their last legs that need to be replaced, and we work with customers to do that, including one that had duct tape holding the door closed. You know, it is what it is. People are doing the best they can with what they have. But it suggests to me that there's been no maintenance been done. So drying cabinets are an integral component of sterile processing departments. They're no different than any other capital equipment in SPD. Routine and preventive maintenance are really going to help prevent problems down the line and allow the cabinet to function and operate as designed to really help with their workflow.
It's just as important as it is for everything else in SPD. It's all
absolutely.
Yeah.
All right. So last question. When someone is looking to purchase a new medical dryer for their sterile processing department, what questions should they consider prior to making the investment?
The most important thing, how does it function? How does the airflow move in the cabinet? Are the shelves going to obstruct the airflow? And what about the heating system? Is it capable of providing a stable and consistent temperature in the entire cabinet? Bob talked about shelves obstructing airflow. You want to make sure that that isn't going to happen so that you have a predictable outcome. Bob, what are some of the other things you would recommend?
First of all, let me reinforce what Ann just answered. That is a really critical question to understand truly the purchasing decision of how that specific cabinet operates relative to its airflow. Really important question. Also, some other questions that really need to be considered asked is, can you adjust the temperature within the cabinet? Mm-hmm. You know, there may be a device in an IFU that is an SPD that requires a lower temperature than the typical set point of 135 degrees. So ask, can I easily adjust the temperature if I have an IFU that states it should be lowered, and how easily can I achieve that? That's a really important question to ask. Also, will the shelves accommodate the larger containers and trays, which are now commonplace, so I don't have to turn them on edge? So there's lots of containers and trays that accommodate certain scopes that are used in the OR. Do I have to figure out how to tip them on edge and put them in the cabinet, or can I just simply slide them into place? So container size is really critical now because they've gotten larger. Relative to shelves, can I adjust them without having to use tools? Can I move them around and configure it the way I want it for my devices so that I'm not just fixed to a fixed set of shelves that I can't reconfigure? Also, again, controls have improved over time relative to drying cabinets. Will that control also notify me when to perform regular maintenance, including filter changes? Or do I have to remember and figure it out on my own? So ask about the controls. Is it just to control the cycle, or will it notify me when to perform regular maintenance? What kind of utilities are required? Ask about that. Electrical requirements. Is the cabinet available as a pass-through configuration? In other words, two doors, one on the clean side, one on the decontam side. How many sizes do you have? So it can accommodate the volume that I have. I might have today a volume that requires a small cabinet, but I may need to grow into a larger one. So do you have multiple sizes? Again, does it have a digital touch screen controls with LED so I can control temperatures and cycles? Does the cabinet have the ability to dry internal lumens of high-risk scopes, specifically around robotic devices? And as the scopes that Ann previously mentioned around ureteroscopes, cystoscopes, bronchoscopes, can you dry those channels as well? And here's something that sometimes is overlooked. For a technician standing far away, or can you see inside the cabinet? Is it lighted so I know what is in there and how many shells are left for me to use? So is the chamber lighted?
May I interrupt you for a minute? I think that's like opening a refrigerator when the light bulb is burned out, you can't see anything? I think that's a really good question.
Exactly.
I see what's in here?
Exactly. HEPA filter, we talked about that. Is that included in the purchase of the cabinet, or is it an option? And again, what's the frequency for changing that HEPA filter? Can the software be upgraded in the future to accommodate new categories of devices, different cycles, different temperature adjustments, etc.? Talk to me about where your cabinets currently are located. Do you have references that I can speak to that may look like my department and how they're currently processing and drying devices in those cabinets? And also, what's the warranty? What is the warranty policy for the manufacturer? Is it cover both parts and labor, and for how long? So those are some of the general questions that should be asked with a discussion relative to decisions around purchasing drying cabinets, that manufacturers should be able to provide those answers, whether it's in person or in writing. That's typically what I would recommend that managers and directors ask of manufacturers.
Well, those are some great considerations. And with that, Anne, Bob, thank you. It's been a pleasure speaking with you. And thank you for sharing with us today on the podcast.
You can tell we love this topic, and thank you for having us.
Absolutely. Thanks, John. Really appreciate it. And again, to everybody listening, thank you for everything you do every day.
Well, folks, that music means only one thing, and I'm sorry to say that we are out of time for today. Thank you, Ann and Bob. Great information, great insight on drying. Thanks again for sharing with us today. HSPA episode 105 is in the books. We're done for today. Thanks for sticking with us. Just remember, each episode we do on the podcast is on demand. So when you're ready for us, we'll be there for you. And as always, stay classy, and we'll see you next time.